Spotlight shine against a black background, illuminating a title, IFC Films. Light bursts behind a glowing moon. Shining letters fade in. Corrado Mooncoin.
Libby.
A black woman in a padded jacket stares forward.
Libby. Libby.
Across the room, her gray-haired superior gets her attention.
You did amazing work. I knew I could count on you.
Eyes glassy, she returns her gaze. Libby slowly looks downward, breaking eye contact. Her senior remains stoic. The older woman begins to type disengaged on her phone. Libby turns away, dismissed. A suited man stands with his back towards the women cross-armed, watching a TV. Libby stares off into the distance, shaking slightly. Cut to black. Words appear, 4 years later. Libby exits a white suburban house, set among trees. She's wearing fitness clothes and locks the door. Readying herself for her run, she massages her neck and looks out off the porch, flexing her shoulders. She then sets off at a jog. Her street is lined with similar three-story homes and cars parked along the street. Her run continues along a waterfront park. In white letters, an acceptable loss. Inside her home, she sits cross-legged on her bed, still wearing her gray tank top and black exercise pants. In the evening, she walks down a hallway, routinely flicking light switches and table lamps off. She sits at a dimly lit wooden desk, removing an item from the drawer and pulling her chair forward. She retrieves a pen from a holder and begins to write. Libby climbs stairs towards her bedroom. She carefully removes decorative pillows, revealing a pistol on the opposite side of the bed. Sitting against a stack of pillows, she retrieves a book from her nightstand. Before opening it, she tilts her head back against the headboard and breathes heavily. Outside, a young man walks along a path with a backpack. He looks fondly at a woman in front of him, tilting his head as his eyes shift towards her behind in tight-fitting jeans. His eyes perk up towards the commotion. A crowd is gathered on the campus quad. They carry white picket signs. He continues on as he checks his surroundings. A police officer motions for calm at the group of mostly young protesters. Their signs cite forgiveness and peace. The young man stops, watching at a distance. He sits in a college lecture hall, craning his neck to see a pretty female student wearing an off-the-shoulder blouse. Two male police officers enter the hall, escorting a female staff member and Libby. Still sitting, the young man follows the group closely with his eyes. He sits up with pointed interest. The two women approach the stage and stand behind a podium.
What a morning. Students, welcome to course number 422, CAP 23, Understanding Contemporary Warfare. I apologize for the hullabaloo you may have encountered entering the building, but it was a one-off, I can assure you. As you may or may not be aware, Professor Shemka, who was scheduled to teach this course, suffered a heart attack some weeks back. In his stead, we are honored to have secured the services and talents of one of the most brilliant and innovative minds in American foreign policy today, Elizabeth Lam. Elizabeth received her BA from Princeton and her PhD from the University of Chicago. Fluent in French, Japanese, Pashto,
Libby and the administrator exit the hall and chat as they descend its steps. They continue through the campus, and the young man follows at a distance. He watches them turn a corner. He pauses, and the pair enter another building.
Winter break, I'm getting a lift here, please. Into the school year, the right one. Already had both knees worked on. I have the best orthopedic guy if you're ever in need.
Not yet, anyway.
Willa? Oh, how did it go? How crazy was it? Were arrests made?
Campus cops handled it with aplomb. A very pleasant surprise. Wouldn't you agree, Elizabeth?
Yes, security was excellent.
Gracious, my manners. Everything's moved so fast, I forget you've only just arrived. Elizabeth, this is Dee.
Elizabeth.
Libby extends her hand. Dee pauses, reluctant, then grasps it.
Without Dee, the office would come to a grinding and very messy halt.
Whatever you need, just let us know.
Thank you. I will.
Martin! There he is, my phantom roommate, the international man of mystery.
Jordan.
Where you been? Look, I know we've only known each other a short time, but I worry. It's my nature, right? I'm like my Jewish grandmother that way. Just shoot me a text or something.
Martin disregards him.
Great seeing you too, Jordan. Thanks for giving a shit. You're right. I could have fallen in the lake and drowned. No one would ever have known.
Thank you.
Yeah, anytime, Rumi.
The young man, Martin, gazes over his shoulder as Jordan leaves.
And this is you.
Willa opens a glass pane door to a simple office with a wooden desk.
I'm afraid it's rather Spartan in terms of creature comforts.
Libby glances around.
It's perfect, actually.
Well, it may not be Foggy Bottom, but welcome to academia. Once everyone gets to know you, Elizabeth, I think you'll find we have a good bunch of folks here. Hearts are in the right place.
It's fine. I'm used to it. Really.
October 21st, 1805. Napoleon.
Martin searches for photos of Libby on his laptop in class.
Pierre de Villeneuve is wiped out by the British fleet under the command of Admiral Horatio Nelson.
He opens an article titled, Protests erupt at Grant over controversial hire.
Establishes Britain's dominance of the high seas for the century to come.
The subheadline reads, former top aide to then VP Rachel Burke met with resistance as she arrives on campus.
If anything, his obsession with crossing the channel only grows after Trafalgar.
Dee at the door.
Am I interrupting?
Not at all.
Couple of housekeeping matters. Would you prefer using your own email for correspondence, or I can set you up with a department address?
Neither. I'm old school that way.
Really?
Really. I prefer hard copies.
Okay. Can I have your cell number for the office?
Don't have one.
You don't have a cell phone?
No, I don't.
Home phone number.
Sorry.
How do you communicate with the world?
Slowly.
Libby briefly shows a slight smile before Dee turns and exits her office. Libby leans back in her chair and looks out her window. Back in her neighborhood, bicycles pass by Libby strolling down a sidewalk. She sees a lively lemonade stand across the street and grins to herself. Martin crosses a street trailing behind her. His eyes stay locked on her while she climbs the stairs to her white home and unlocks the door. She enters and he continues by. She punches the code to an alarm, which then glows green. At her desk that night, she writes with purpose on a pad of paper. In a memory.
It's all so close, isn't it? The pieces, the stars, they are aligning.
Libby sits across her white-haired superior on a waterfront porch.
What a view you have here. majestic. The entire compound is just breathtaking.
Thank you. It's been in my family for generations. I don't really like the lake. Too many bugs, water's too cold, no sand. I know, right? Poor me.
Libby glances away.
You're having doubts.
In the present, she continues on her notepad. Later, Libby's in a white clawfoot tub. She looks towards the open door. She grabs her gun, pointing it towards an unseen target. She follows the sound with her aimed pistol. Exhaling in relief, she lowers the weapon, unloads the magazine, and checks the loaded bullets. She relaxes back into the tub and closes her eyes. Back on campus, Martin rides a bike. He dismounts and parks it at a bike rack. He enters his dorm room with his laptop in hand. He slings his backpack to the floor and sets the computer down at his desk. Martin enters a password for a user named Cinders. A red skull icon adorns the screen. He immediately opens an article written by Libby titled, Total Victory is Just That, Total. Libby leads a seminar.
By that definition, the U.S. military uses WMDs every day and theoretically could be prosecuted by foreign governments if they were to adopt a similar law. For example, the M67 hand grenade is a fragmentation device with an explosive charge of 6.5 ounces. So it qualifies as a WMD on two counts. Tanisha?
When you say prosecuted by foreign governments, you mean prosecuted as war criminals.
That exact definition, that wording, I believe is a matter for the courts to decide.
At dusk, Libby walks to another lecture hall. She turns around, checking behind her, then continues up its steps.
Does a figure this polarizing earn the right to be...
In his unlit dorm room, Martin continues his research.
Some will say yes, some will say no. Some will say she shouldn't even be walking free, but you have to look to the GU administration for the real reason behind this.
Money.
Oh, don't worry. Exactly.
Jordan, his roommate, and another man enter, kissing.
Oh, fuck!
What the fuck?
Now, Martin? You show up now?
Just leaving.
What? We can go in my room. You don't
have to... No, I'm out of here. Thanks.
He exits.
What was he doing in the dark like that?
This is what I've been saying.
Martin bikes at speed down a lamplit street. Libby is again in her home study, writing in her notepad. She returns to the memory.
I am concerned much of the analysis is unsubstantiated. Some will say it's all circumstantial.
Well, that's nonsense. Do you think it's circumstantial?
No, I do not. But wanting to believe...
Do you realize that Pearl Harbor to VJ Day was less than 4 years? A world at war. And we ended it just that quickly? This thing has been going on since the turn of the century. We've turned a sideshow into the main event.
But the response has to be specific, surgical. I do think we need to take into account the reactions, both at home and abroad.
Doesn't it bother you that the idea of American exceptionalism is an anachronism?
Of course.
We're a rudderless ship where just getting by is enough. And Los Angeles certainly showed how tenuous even that is. If Malecki's tire does not blow out, if the CHP does not pull over, if Malecki does not panic, if prevented a catastrophe that would have made 9/11 look like a footnote. Now, I don't sleep well at night knowing that. We have to win this war. Total victory.
She stops writing abruptly and looks out of her window, noticing movement. She puts her pen down and turns off her desk lamp. Opening the drawer in her desk, she returns the notepad, placing it on top of several similar ones already inside. She locks it before stepping away. In an alley, Martin jumps back on his bike, taking off in a hurry. Libby is sitting on the edge of her bed, holding her pistol in her left hand. Martin is laying on sand, staring at the dawn sky. He sits up and looks towards the horizon with a thoughtful expression on his face. In her gray tank top and exercise pants, Libby runs down her neighboring sidewalks. She passes a neighbor and turns towards her front door. At the curb is a van with a locksmith logo on it. A worker kneels at her front door, working on the locks.
Thanks for coming on such short notice.
So you want all of these changed?
Plus the mudroom and back door. I want to add more locks there too. A different key for each.
Okay.
He double takes towards her.
You have a robbery?
No.
Not happy with your alarm system?
No, it's fine.
If you want cameras, I have
no cameras. Thanks.
I'll get to it.
He walks to retrieve tools from his van. The locksmith drills a new hole in her brown door. Martin walks along the stacks of a library. He sits at a cubicle. On his laptop, he puts together an ad for $29 lawn services, titling the company Nature Stand Lawn and Garden. Martin returns to his dorm room. Jordan is sitting on a love seat with his own laptop.
Sorry if I spooked you guys last night. Is he... No.
Neil's gone.
Martin steps out of the living room. Jordan looks after him in frustration. Jordan stands up and follows after Martin.
Hey, if we want this roommate thing to work out, we need to communicate a little bit better. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So if you have a problem with my bringing Neil back here...
I don't have a problem with that.
Okay, so what is your problem?
I don't have a fucking problem.
Look, Martin, we don't really know each other. I get the sense you're one of those extremely gifted, self-motivated types. Your test scores, the Ivy League pedigree, the awards. Frankly, a little intimidating, but I applaud all that, seriously. It's just the sneaking around that weirds me out a bit.
Sneaking around? What the fuck does that mean?
You just seem really unhappy. Maybe you should talk to someone.
You know, if you want a new roommate, you just go ahead and say it.
That's not what I'm saying.
Oh, fuck it. I'll put him for a single next semester.
No, that's not what I'm saying.
Hey, I get it, Jordan. It's what I'm saying.
Martin leaves with his backpack, leaving Jordan frozen. Martin rubs his temple, breathing heavily. He sets off. He's walking down the suburban street and stops. Libby is in the distance, exiting her house in a purple dress and heels. Entering a metro train platform, Martin spots Libby, who is standing near the edge. Martin rides the train, staring through the windows between his and another car at Libby. Cars drive by in a city. Martin exits the underground station and sees Libby walking away. Under a brightly lit overhang, she walks into a glass-walled building. She sits at a table across from a gray-bearded gentleman.
And the paper. Is it good?
Oh, circulation continues to dwindle. Last time I checked, we had a grand total of 43,000 subscribers. The entire newsroom is comprised of an ever-dwindling 25, myself included. Dwindling being the key word here.
Can I help you?
Towards whispering onlookers.
At least they didn't try to take a picture.
So sorry, Mr. Lamb. Just a couple of minutes and your table will be ready.
Thank you very much.
Martin watches Libby and her father through a large ground floor window.
You were saying about the paper?
Oh, that's it, really. You know, sometimes I think that leaving the Post was the biggest mistake of my professional career. And then I remember I wasn't even given a choice in the matter.
Daddy, I am so sorry if I had anything to do with you losing.
It was not your fault. You know that. Even your mother is.
Does she know how I feel?
She read your letters. Yes.
And she still refuses to see me.
We were so proud of you. So proud of your accomplishments.
Where? And now you're ashamed.
Libby sits in restless thought on the train. Martin is a few benches behind her. She begins to glance over her shoulder as though she knows she's being watched. Martin looks away for a moment, then returns his gaze. At home, she continues to write down her memories.
We have to win this war. Total victory. Now, more than anyone, you have done more to prepare this country for this moment. So connect the dots that need to be connected. And if the stars need help aligning, do so. Talk to Adrian. The DI is with us on this.
The gray-haired woman sits forward and clasps Libby's hands in hers.
People want to believe what you say. Use that gift. And if you see this through to its logical end, your future, your legacy, will be assured. You will have served your country honorably.
Libby begins to nod. From outside her house, the light in her study turns off. Martin watches and operates a digital device. Libby ascends a set of old stairs. Faces and framed posters adorn the walls. Entering a room, her eyes settle on a small safe sitting atop a dresser.
Do you see it?
Found it.
Quite beautiful.
Built in 1900 by the legendary J.D. McCarthy Safe and Lock Company out of Cincinnati. It's in excellent condition.
The lock still works?
You look awfully familiar. Have we met?
No, I'm afraid not.
Of course. Excuse me. I just want to say thank you. For your service to the country, you did what had to be done, and we're safer for it.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you feel safe.
Now let's open this bad boy.
Martin enters an electronics store and kneels to look into the display of cameras and security devices.
A little help, please.
Continuing our discussion of Clausewitz and war. In 1832, he wrote, "Kind-hearted people might, of course, think there was some ingenious way to disarm or defeat the enemy without too much bloodshed, and might imagine this as the true goal of the art of war. Pleasant as it sounds, it is a fallacy that must be exposed."
Martin sits in the class,
war
thinking deeply.
"It's a dangerous business that mistakes that come from kindness are the very worst."
Later, he walks down the sidewalk. He's carrying a brochure for Nature's Stand Lawn Services as he approaches Libby's doorstep. He slides the paper around her doorknob and, glancing to check his surroundings, snaps photos with his phone of the newly installed locks on her door. He walks away from the house calmly, carrying remaining brochures in his hands. After taking another look around, He walks around the side of the house. He continues to take photos of various elements of the house. As he walks past one last tree on the side lawn, he finds a seemingly unguarded basement window and stops to take more pictures. In a library workstation, Martin has a photo of the window on his laptop. He begins to pull a latex glove onto his right hand, then stops and takes a closer zoomed-in look at the window. He finishes pulling the glove all the way to his wrist. On his computer, he opens a web page of the same company that handles the security of Libby's home. Back at his dorm room, Jordan is on the small couch with his computer. Martin walks past him without acknowledgement as Jordan turns to look. Martin closes his bedroom door and opens a drawer to remove a small black case and several tools, which he places in his backpack. Closing the drawer, he exits the small apartment. Jordan glances after him. Libby walks up the stairs of a university building, greeted by students waiting for her to arrive. Martin returns to Libby Street as the sun sets, keeping his head low. Walking around the side of the house, Martin begins to pull on a latex glove. He goes directly to the basement window and kneels beside it, putting on a glove on his other hand. Taking off his backpack, he pulls out a small device with two antennas. He turns it on, and its screen shows RF Explorer. He begins to move it around the panes on the window. It finds a signal and shows waveforms on its small screen. He places it down, then retrieves a small crowbar from his backpack. He inserts it into the corner of the window frame and applies pressure. The window comes free, and he deftly puts a magnet against the sensor inside the frame, stopping the alarm from being triggered. He takes the entire window out and lays it on the ground. Martin nimbly climbs through the window, landing on a work table against the wall. Once on the ground, he reaches back out and grabs his backpack. Martin climbs the stairs of the dimly lit house. He looks at a small table lamp, then continues into the bedroom. Using a flashlight, he looks towards the crisply made bed and then the bathtub. He presses lightly on the bed and continues to a vanity in the corner, picking up and smelling one of the perfumes. On a dresser, he finds a letter opener atop a pile of letters. His gloved hand lifts it, and he looks closely at it with the flashlight. He opens her drawers and takes out a single undergarment, which he returns before closing the drawer. He puts his flashlight on the ground and, kneeling, pulls a small case and a plastic bag out of his pack. He empties the plastic bag's contents onto the small case. It's three minuscule cameras. Martin is sitting in front of his laptop. A live video feed is open, showing a night vision view of Libby's bedroom. She's sleeping soundly in her bed. Martin glances up at the opening of a door. He's alone at a long table in a collegiate building. Closing the video feed, he looks through a list of recordings. He finds one titled Desk Cam. He loads it and rewinds, resuming playback once Libby is on screen writing at her desk. Tapping his keys, he zooms in 500%. Libby continues to write in the pixelated video. He zooms back out, then fast forwards until she leaves the room with her notebook. Switching feeds, Martin follows her progress as she enters into the bedroom. He zooms in again to see her walk to a safe, now next to her bed. He watches closely as she unlocks it and places the notebook inside. She closes the door and resets the lock. He switches back to the live feed and continues to watch her as she sleeps. Libby exits her house in the morning in her workout gear and begins to lock each of the locks on her front door. She pauses with a worried expression, then turns around. A man in a dark suit exits a black SUV from the back seat, then walks towards the house.
Hey, Libby. It's good to see you.
Adrian.
Flashbacks of them together in a government office.
How late?
About 3. Waiting for a mom to check in.
I missed waking up to you this morning.
Me too.
I guess I've become kind of used to it.
Me too.
The Iman call. What you wanted to hear?
No.
But the stars aren't aligning.
Not funny.
Did you tell Rachel?
Nope.
Are you waiting for the right moment?
I don't think there is a right moment.
She would like to see you.
Thanks. As if I'm cute.
She takes a pen and several binders off her desk. He stops her as she walks past him, still seated. She smiles as they clasp hands. Then she touches his face.
Tonight.
She exits the office. In a modern bedroom, Libby is on top of Adrian. They're kissing passionately, hands pressed against each other's bare backs while they move in unison. They pause to look at one another and smile. Still in bed.
The paper trail has to be...
airtight. Commission proof.
This is not just any op, Adrian.
I get it.
We are way past cherry-picking evidence.
It is understood.
Just think. We can end this thing. Once and for all.
Hey, your boss wants it done. My boss wants it done. That's good enough for me.
The intel has to be credible and actionable. Especially on Vedat, he is the key.
We'll get you visas, travel itineraries, whatever we can provide. Now put that pad away. Get back over here.
Smiling, she closes her notepad, then climbs back from the edge of the bed. In the present.
Can we talk? Inside?
No. Not inside.
Where then? Because I'm not leaving till we do.
Follow me.
Libby jogs off down the street. Adrian returns to the car and motions to his driver to follow after her. In his bedroom, Martin scrolls through photos of Libby and Adrian together.
Yeah.
Hey, Martin, can I come in?
He closes his laptop.
Yeah.
Jordan enters his room.
Yeah? Did you hear about Sunday? Nope. What about Sunday?
Dr. Seip is having a get-together at her house for faculty and department grad students.
No, I didn't hear about that, but, thanks for the heads up.
Do you think you'll go?
Yeah, I do.
I hate going to these things. Alone. Would it be okay if we went together?
Sure. Thank you.
Martin nods as Jordan exits. On a bench.
So what's with the, no phone, no email, kind of, but not really off the grid nonsense?
Keeps it all very simple. I guess I should congratulate you on your appointment. Chief of staff to the President of the United States. How does it feel?
It feels right.
Well... I'm glad it all worked out for you.
We're concerned about you, Libby. We've reached out several times.
Reaching out in regards to the president's intent to run for re-election.
And the silence is deafening. We need to make sure you're still part of our team. Are you, Libby, still part of our team?
You flew all this way to hear me answer that question.
I flew all this way to see you answer that question.
I served faithfully. I did everything I was asked to do, everything.
Back then.
You don't... Does it ever give you...
No. The decision was made, an order was given. Period.
Easy as that.
Just the one thing. What happened to you and me that did hurt? But, Libby, the understanding was you'd resign and we'd all say nice things about one another. Presidential medals of freedom and all that. We're not asking you to be the centerpiece of the campaign. We're just looking for a unified front. You may have detractors, but your overall favorable rating within the party, 70%. So when I do reach out and I hear nothing, take that as a fuck you. And being the trusting guy that I am, I begin to think that maybe Libby's having second thoughts. Maybe Libby's thinking of airing the family's dirty laundry. I cannot overemphasize what a colossally dangerous idea that would be.
Stop following me. I know you have people watching.
I can assure you it's not coming from my office.
How about your old buddies at Langley?
Is that what's happening, Libby? Are you suspicious of everyone now?
Like I said, tell your people to leave me alone.
You're a very attractive woman, Libby. Sometimes the answer to a problem is a very simple explanation. The obvious one.
He stands to leave.
I'm here in good faith. Because of your service to the president and the country. Because Rachel still considers you a friend. I wouldn't be speaking here now if it was otherwise.
So, I've been warned.
Counseled. This memoir you threatened to write has Rachel worried. You're either with us or against us. It's as simple as that. Let's talk again. Soon, okay?
She remains seated in thought on the bench, and Adrian walks away. Martin walks down the street, two strides ahead of Jordan, who is wearing a tan suit. Martin's hands are in his jacket pockets. They pass a tall metal gate walking towards the front door of a house. People mingle inside.
What now?
Mingle.
You're first.
Yeah, I'll join you. If Ben is okay.
Jordan, I know I can be a first-class jerk. I don't want to single next semester. You're a great roommate, and I think I can be a good one, too, if that works for you.
Does that mean I can join you for that beer?
We're bonding.
Jordan smiles. Libby sits in front of her vanity, carefully glossing her lips. She runs her hands along her hair, then leans forward and exhales deeply.
Then they remove the damaged cartilage and bone from the... Now, here's my new word of the day, acetabulum. There's our new celebrity in residence, Elizabeth. So glad you made it. Let me make some introductions.
I apologize for sounding like my parents, but kids these days, no matter how...
Libby is losing interest in the conversation and meets eyes with Dee across the room.
I'm talking about...
Dee averts her eyes, then exits the room with a last glance at Libby.
I don't know how that
Martin is sitting in the corner nursing a beer.
Together. For that matter, how the hell did they get into this university? I'm asking you.
Washington in the summer? You can have it. The humidity, the mosquitoes, yuck.
Libby grabs another drink.
Oh, you get used to it.
Enjoying the show. Ah, the glamorous Elizabeth Lamb, the architect of total victory and the Burke Doctrine. Kill one of ours, we kill 1,000 of yours. Isn't that the gist of it?
Something like that, yeah.
Have you met her?
Not yet.
Introduce yourself.
When the time's right.
So how long are you here for?
The semester. Mm. We'll see how it goes after that.
Are you staying near campus, or... in the city where the action
is. Near campus.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How about you? You doing the old meet and greet?
Yeah, a couple of... Hi, I'm Jordan Ritt. That's Ritt with two T's. So thrilled to be taking your class. Excellent conversation, if I do say so myself.
Congratulations on that.
Yes, it is a fine art.
Big homes in that area, though. It's a lot of house for one person.
I like it. I like the space.
Really? You don't find it too quiet, too lonely?
No.
Did you buy?
Rent.
Furnished?
Almost.
So what are you sleeping on? Did they leave you a bed?
Libby takes another sip.
Elizabeth, how often do you encounter protests these days? I mean, was Tuesday an anomaly, or is it typical?
Now, I promised Elizabeth there would be no grilling, no inquisition, not tonight.
Willa, I'm just asking Elizabeth if every time she walks out into the world, she has to deal with those haters.
It's okay, Willa, really. I see it on campuses still. That's about it. I resigned my post 4 years ago. After that, I was a figure of controversy. Protests were common, people were upset. But as time went by, it receded and it was replaced by new controversies. Toynbee was right. History is just one damn thing after another.
But some things are more damnable than others, aren't they? What you did was unconscionable.
Larry.
Not here.
Willa, you should be ashamed. You bring this woman in? All you guys, do you realize what we're legitimizing here?
Larry, please. We are all aware that liquor brings out your unfulfilled penchant for theatrics.
What the fuck does that even mean?
It means you're stupid drunk.
The only way I can stand to be around her. How many? Come on. You know the number. How many people?
Based on the information that was available at the time.
How many?
There's always the unknown.
Say it!
Larry, drop this. Now.
With tears in her eyes, she unlocks her home and begins to rip off her shoes and dress. She stands against the wall in the shower, still in her undergarments. Her sobs mix with the streams of water. She turns and leans with both hands against the glass wall of her shower, choking on her tears. Slowly sliding down the wall, she sits down under the downpour, placing her head in her hands. Wet and defeated, she stands next to her still-made bed. From a computer monitor, she's standing still, visible from a vantage point on her ceiling. Martin, still dressed in his clothes from the evening, is watching his laptop among the stacks in the library. Another memory with Rachel.
Come on, intel changes nothing.
Two, maybe three of our guys won't be there, at least not during the window.
The dot.
Not confirmed.
Changes nothing, but we stress that you're irrefutable. I mean, in and of itself, the evidence at hand is overwhelming.
When we include the DIs and intel, yes.
Right, but it's commission proof, correct?
Yes.
All right, good enough for me. I just want a moment alone with Elizabeth, please.
Adrian stands in place as the two women enter the elevator.
There's one more thing. I've changed my mind. I'm recommending we now go with Directive 712.
You were in agreement with a more conventional approach.
It's a message that has to be sent. Libby, it's become clear to me this is much bigger than Homs. We are sending a message to the world. Don't fuck with us anymore.
The discussions with the DOD, they've all been about...
Look, I've wrestled with it. I'm convinced the stars have aligned.
I'm urging you to reconsider 710. The multiple drones...
These people are like needles in a haystack.
But to burn down the entire barn.
When the moment comes, you will know what to do.
Libby is left in question as Rachel exits. On the video feed, Libby falls to her knees against her bed. She pulls the covers towards her face in anguish and sobs again. Libby returns to her desk with several notepads. She places them down and takes a seat. Removing the pen from a crescent holder, she begins to write again. Time fades by. The evening becomes day with light shining through her windows. She rests her head on her hand and continues without pause. Libby continues to write, deep in thought. She completes an entire notepad of paper and pulls a new blank one towards her and begins to write. Day then turns to night. She pauses to stretch her hands, fingers, and wrists. Martin is still watching her via live feed at her desk. With a new thought, she returns to her notepads and finishes her writing with a quote. We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. The quote is by T.S. Eliot. She returns her pen to its metal stand and stacks the three notebooks from the session. Via video feed, she stands and carries them out of the room. In her bedroom, Martin zooms to see her unlock the safe. Inside are more than 10 identical notepads. She adds the newly completed ones alongside them and locks the safe. She enters her seminar.
Evening.
Martin walks on the sidewalk and back around the side of her house. He pulls latex gloves on as he strides. He drops his bag onto the workbench inside the window and follows after it. Gently jumping down, he pulls out his phone. He sets a 2-hour timer and then grabs his pack.
Rapid release of energy in such an explosion creates a shockwave equivalent to several thousand pounds of pressure per square inch, enough to crush brick houses and human lungs and most objects on Earth.
Martin ascends stairs. Libby notices Adrian outside her seminar door's window.
Thus we see the increased incidence of leukemia and thyroid, lung, breast, and bone cancers.
Excuse me, Luis, class, give me a minute, please. I'll be right back.
She stands up from the head of the table and walks towards the door. Meanwhile, Martin kneels in front of the safe. Following her a few steps, Adrian waits for Libby to speak first.
What are you doing here?
I told you we were going to finish our conversation.
Now you're threatening me.
I just want the answer to the question.
Leave me alone.
Libby.
No.
No what?
No. I'm no longer on your fucking team!
Martin's gloved hands begin to remove tools from a case.
So we can't count on you?
Count on me to tell the truth.
What then? Your memoir goes public and you're at peace? Why are you making this so hard on yourself? If you think you're in the wilderness now?
Cross-armed, she rolls her eyes and strides back towards her class.
Sorry, everyone. I have to go. Class dismissed. We'll make it up.
Martin inserts a cable into a digital device. He places an earbud into each ear. Adrian is still outside the classroom when Libby exits.
You say nothing and nothing changes.
The timer on Martin's phone shows 1 hour and 19 minutes. He starts the digital device, which shows rapidly changing numbers. He attaches a lead to the front of the safe and starts to turn the knob, watching the screen of the device as he works. The safe unlocks and he pulls it open, revealing the notepads. Pulling the most recent one out, Martin begins to skim the handwritten pages. He places down the first and retrieves the second notepad, checking again, page by page.
Put that down. And move slowly away from the safe.
Libby is standing in the doorway. Her pistol is pointed directly at Martin's back. He rotates his neck and torso slowly, still on his knees, to face her. He drops the pad and puts his hands up.
Sit on the bed. Hands to your side, palms on the covers.
He walks to the bed and sits on the edge, careful to keep his hands in her sight.
You were following me.
Can you not point the gun in my face?
You were just a motherfucking stalker. I would be within my right to shoot you dead here and now.
No, I'm not that kind of stalker.
Bullshit.
I'm not, Dr. Lamb.
You were in my class. And at Dr. Sipes.
Yes, I'm a graduate student.
Were you sent here? Someone paying you?
No.
Then you have one chance to answer this question correctly. If I don't like what I hear, I'm either going to kill you or call the cops.
You don't have a phone.
Why are you here?
I'll put it this way. Say I'm a Jew. I'm not. Say I am. Now, as a child, I learned my grandparents, they were murdered at Auschwitz. What do? I immerse myself in a subject. All the camps, attending horrors. I study hard, I excel. Full tuition scholarships. Get them into, you know, prestigious universities, both graduate and undergraduate. Now, at said graduate university, on my first class, on my first day, I look up and see Dr. Mengele standing at the lectern. For Dr. Mengele has been given an honorary chair in the political science department and will be lecturing me.
She lowers her gun.
You had family there.
What you committed was an atrocity, a crime against humanity.
We believed we were making the world a safer place. We believed we were protecting this country.
Shut up! You're a fucking war criminal, and you should be hung as such.
What's your name?
Martin Solly.
Okay. Martin Solly. You have your Mengele. You're staring into the abyss. Now what? Do you want to kill me?
She offers him her gun.
No. I
I just want to understand how evil works.
Evil?
Yeah. I want to know everything. Like, does it wear silk? Or eat off fine china? Does it drink latte? How does it take the unthinkable and make it real, you know? Does it have remorse? You know, how does it keep going? I want to know the big questions. I want to know the details. I want to know everything. I just want to understand everything.
Sit back down. Please. Martin. Sit back down.
He looks around, then returns to the edge of the bed expectantly. She steps towards the safe and pulls several of the notepads out.
Read it. You want to understand? Read it. All of it.
He pulls away a single notepad from the stack.
Start there.
Mr. President, because time is of the essence, I've asked my National Security Affairs Advisor, Elizabeth Lam, to address the group. Elizabeth has taken all the intel, phone intercept, satellite imagery, signals intelligence, and human assets. And I think you will agree that her findings are definitive and convincing, necessitating immediate and total action, if she may.
Smartest person in the room. You bet. Elizabeth, please.
Libby hesitates, then stands in front of the windowless boardroom of over 20 officials.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, we are currently presented with a moment in time in which a single decisive act could literally change the course of history. The evidence and opportunity is undeniable. Omar al-Abadi, ISIL, Kamal Latif, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Sajjad al-Jaber, Jabhat al-Nusra, Mudar al-Hazmi, Hezbollah, Khalid Sadu, Jaish al-Sham, and Dr. S.Q. Vadat, former head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, and quite possibly the most dangerous man in the world. Unbeknownst to one another, these six men, five leaders of terrorist organizations, and Dr. Vadat, a rogue agent dedicated to the proliferation of nuclear weapons technology, will all be in the same city, Homs, Syria, at the same time this very evening.
Excuse me, Elizabeth, where is Homs exactly?
Approximately 162 kilometers north of Damascus.
Nodding, still unsure.
That's
about 100 miles.
Got it. Thank you. Never did get the damn metric system.
Our best estimate is a four-hour overlap between 10 p.m. and 2 a.m. local time, in which these known enemies will be within the city of Homs, all targets of opportunity. A strike to the heart of Homs at this moment would cripple, if not terminate, the threat of terrorism this country has faced for nearly three decades, at the cost of thousands of lives and trillions of dollars. It is approximately 7:05 p.m. local time, giving us just under 5 hours to approve and execute the action.
And what type of strike are you proposing?
Well, we've prepared three scenarios in which...
Elizabeth, excuse me. I'm going to interrupt. Ladies and gentlemen, if we act now, we can defeat these primeval bastards once and for all. Now, Elizabeth is going to walk us through some scenarios, but I am convinced that our response should be total and absolute. Elizabeth, if you would continue, please.
Thank you, Madam Vice President.
Martin finishes a notepad. Pulling more from the safe, Libby hands them to Martin.
What the vice president and her staff are advocating is unprecedented. Whatever short-term gain this action might achieve, we would be opening Pandora's box. We become the pariah.
May I remind the Admiral that the 712 calls for a tactical weapon?
Tactical nuclear weapon. It has been the stated policy of this nation never to be the first to use a nuclear device in any conflict. That has been doctrine since the end of World War II.
He has a point, Rachel.
If you were president at this moment, would you be willing to personally authorize a nuclear strike that would kill countless innocent men, women, and children?
Yes. The whole point of a deterrent is that our enemies need to know we are prepared to use it. They need to understand we will punish their fathers and mothers, husbands and wives and children. Everyone they love and cherish will be held accountable. Now, it's a different century. It's a different world. This war on terror is unique in terms of who the enemy is and how to combat that enemy. And if there is any doubt about the stakes, need I remind everyone at this table about Los Angeles?
Madam Vice President, there is no credible evidence that Malecki had any connection to Vedat's group.
That's your opinion. Mine? That Vedat and these gangsters are committed to detonating a nuclear device in an American city in the next 24 months.
They don't have that capability.
Not yet!
She points her finger, then sits back.
Mr. President, our window of opportunity is under 3 hours, and there is nothing that I have heard at this table that refutes Elizabeth's analysis and evidence. In one fell swoop, we can win this war and end this worldwide scourge.
The advisors look towards the president.
Elizabeth?
Yes, Mr. President.
Do you agree with the vice president's recommendation regarding the 712?
Of course I do, Mr. President.
And you're confident these six men will be at this place at this time?
I am.
Especially Dr. Vedat?
Yes, Mr. President.
You know, after I won my third championship at Texas, people just kept asking me, Coach, what's the secret to winning? And I would always tell them, commitment. Total commitment. So, let's go win this thing.
The attendees stare at the TV screen positioned on one end of the boardroom. From an aerial video feed, a bright light flashes at 12:37 a.m. A mushroom cloud erupts, decimating a massive diameter. Libby turns her head away. Rachel and the president sit stoically. Advisors look down in subtle awe.
Once the initial reports are in, I'll address the nation. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Mr. President.
They all stand as the president exits. Rachel and Libby return to their seats, along with a single advisor. Rachel begins to type on her phone, unfazed. Martin is still reading. Finished notepads are stacked beside him on the bed. The advisor stands and walks towards the TV. In the present, Libby pulls aside a curtain, revealing daylight. The advisor switches the TV to a football game.
Nuclear bombs dropped in the base of falsified intelligence. These have to be published immediately.
These go to one person first. They read it, they publish.
No, why wait?
It's very important to me. This person is the one who publishes my story.
Who else knows?
On the outside? Just you, Martin.
Libby checks the bullets in the magazine of the gun.
Does it make you feel safe?
No.
They look up. Through the window, a tan work van is across the street outside.
We should go back.
She grabs his backpack and begins packing the notepads.
There are elements within the White House and intelligence community who will use every resource at their disposal to make sure these never see the light of day.
What's the you're saying? That's who's outside right now?
A lock shoots against the wall as an intruder starts drilling through the second set of deadbolts.
The basement. I got a way out.
He leads her to the window he used for entry in the basement. He crawls through, and she follows with a bag. They run together, crouching low along fences. The pistol is still in her hand. They break into an all-out run towards another building.
Hold up here.
They enter a large abandoned room with columns of paned windows. They sit down to catch their breath.
I have nothing on me.
Rifling through his wallet.
I got student ID, about $65, credit card, about $150 and change.
Your phone.
Oh, shit.
Leave it here. Let's go.
He drops his phone and they continue to run. Back on the sidewalk, they maintain a brisk walk.
Should we go to the cops or FBI? I mean, everyone can't be involved, right?
She turns to look over her shoulder.
This way.
Why?
The trees. Complicate satellite and drone surveillance. Low tech can beat high tech. Looking at it from there, and this needs to be a limited op. Surgical. Exposure can't be a risk. Questions can't be asked. A snatch and grab on these streets in this town would be a last resort.
So hide in plain sight?
As best as we can.
We'll need money.
Martin runs towards Jordan on a quad and motions to speak with him in a utility closet.
This trouble you're in, you can't tell me any more about it?
No.
What, for like my protection or something? Really?
I'm trying to right a wrong. If it wasn't important, really important, I wouldn't be here.
Shit, Martin, you realize how bizarre this is?
Please.
How much do you need?
$400.
Yes, I can get that.
Thank you, Jordan. Okay, thank you. Could you also swing by the room, get my laptop?
Yeah.
Maybe grab a sweater?
Yeah. Anything else while we're at it?
That's it, promise.
I take it you need all this as soon as...
Right now works best, actually.
Whatever it is you're doing here, I hope it works out okay. Be safe.
Jordan walks off. Martin continues through the library, descending stairs to the stacks and deeper into a dimly lit, broad tunnel. He opens an outside stairwell door and lets Libby, now wearing a hooded sweatshirt, inside.
How do you know to get in and out like this?
Making my business to know every exit of every building I step foot in. You never know when some dickhead with a gun might open up. I used to think I was just being paranoid.
They close the door to a study room. Martin pulls out his laptop and hesitates before opening it.
I gotta show you something.
Turning it towards her, he opens the camera feeds of her house. She glares at him.
we're seeing. Is it now?
No, yesterday.
The feed continues, and in fast forward, Martin enters the room to break open the safe. Libby holds him at gunpoint. Then Martin reads the notepads. Libby packs up her memoir, and they exit the room.
This is this morning. We leave, they enter.
In the living room, a group of men enter and begin searching throughout the home. One of them notices the camera and steps toward it to disable it. Each of the other cameras are similarly disconnected. At the study room door, she pulls the gun.
No, don't.
Door's open.
Hey, are you guys finishing here? Because we reserved the room, so.
Yep. Can you give us a minute?
Yeah, absolutely.
Take your time. Thanks.
They close the laptop and exit through the tunnel stairwell.
Any ideas?
Regarding?
Where to go? Where to hide until morning?
Yeah, I got one.
On a moonlit sandy beach.
We're taking the story to your father, right?
Yes.
He runs a newspaper downstate.
He's the editor. Yes.
What if he won't print it?
He'll print it, Martin.
Okay, but what if he can't? Honestly, I've been thinking about just grabbing the backpack and running. Dumping the story, just getting it out.
You've had opportunity. What's been stopping you?
Because it's your story, and I respect that. Your father, what's he like?
He's a good man. Honest. And caring. That's what you want a dad to be. Yours?
He was all that. He was there 19th of June. Visiting his mother and father. Beautiful son.
This never ends. Do you believe in the hereafter?
Heaven? No.
I do. And I know I'm gonna have to answer for what I've done. Martin, maybe you should go. Either I get to Springfield tomorrow or I don't. But I have a chance, thanks to you.
My father's dead. Well, my mother, she may as well be, she never recovered. These pages are important to you. And they're important to me, too.
Libby is laying on the sand, her eyes open. Martin is beside her, turned the opposite way. Libby sits up and walks to the water. She places her hands in it, bringing some to her face. The stock of a gun knocks her hard on the temple. Feet are visible behind Martin. The men rifle through the backpack, finding the notepads and the pistol. Martin wakes groggily in the morning. Looking around, he notices Libby's absence. The backpack is still beside him.
Dr. Lam?
He walks toward the water. His eyes are still half shut as he takes in his surroundings. He turns and looks back at the beach. Suddenly, he runs towards the bag. He pulls out the pistol and a notepad. Libby is led through a military jet hangar, her face covered by a black sack. Two heavily armed soldiers in bulletproof vests walk alongside her. They sit her down in a storage room and remove the cover on her face. Rachel strides along a hallway, accompanied by Adrian and another soldier. Zip ties are removed from Libby's wrists as Rachel approaches.
Hello, Libby.
Madam President.
In a city, a metro train rides along elevated tracks. Martin is walking along the sidewalk carrying the backpack. He spots two construction workers and turns to face the windows of a street-side electronics shop. He checks over his shoulder as they pass him.
I apologize. I think the team got a little overzealous. Gentlemen, if you will excuse me, I'd like a moment alone with Elizabeth. Oh, come on, Adrian. It'll be fine. Gentlemen, please, go.
They hesitate before leaving. The president takes a seat opposite Libby, who's still wearing the borrowed sweatshirt. Rachel reaches out and clasps Libby's hands, bringing them towards her.
Libby, I hope my just being here will convince you that what I'm about to say is the truth and it comes from my heart. Despite all that's happened and all that's been said, I still consider you a friend, a dear friend. You served me and this country brilliantly. A service that I believe deserves to be recognized and honored.
I was at a party recently and somebody reminded me of the number. Do you remember the number, Madam President?
Of course I do. 150. 150,000 people died in Homs that night. I will always remember that number. You know the story, Libby. General Sherman in the Civil War, mayor of Atlanta pleads with him to save a city. And the general says to the mayor just before he torches it, war is cruel. War is cruelty. We were at war, and we did what needed to be done, and our country is safer for it. The stars aligned. We slayed the dragon, and we won.
If there is any victory here, it has fallen on us.
Libby, I offered you the position of Secretary of State 4 years ago, and I am offering it to you again.
Madam President, respectfully, we ginned up the evidence, and 150,000 innocent people were vaporized.
Okay, so help me understand it. You were fine with drone strikes. 5 innocents here, 10 innocents there. What's the humane number? 100? 1,000? 10,000? Where do you draw the line?
That bomb was dropped on a lie. I just can't live with that anymore.
Rachel stands up.
Tell me about your manuscript.
In a crowded train station, Martin stands online. The backpack is slung on his shoulders. Martin notices two men in suits across the station. He begins to walk away, and the men, motioning to each other, follow. One of them touches an earpiece and speaks into it. Martin shuffles between commuters and vanishes between several of them.
And the young man, he's a good-looking boy. How's he involved?
He's not. Leave him be.
Martin descends stone steps in the grand building, passing others on their way up.
And the cameras in your house. What's that about?
None of your business.
Martin enters a bathroom. He closes a stall door and sets the backpack down. Taking a seat, he fervently unzips the bag and checks each pocket. He quickly dislodges keys from his jacket and continues his search. He removes and shakes out his jacket, then slips his hands into his jean pockets. He pulls off his shirt and shakes it too.
I think I'm beginning to understand your dilemma.
My dilemma? Libby, you're this close to being charged with sedition and treason.
You don't know if there is a copy. Now, the obvious move would be to grab Martin when you grab me. He might be on the other side of that wall this very moment. That's the obvious move. That's not the Rachel Burke I know.
No? So what's the other response then?
Follow the money. Follow the boy to see if he leads you to that copy. The obvious downside to that approach is the more time allowed, the greater the opportunity for unfortunate mischief.
Martin closely inspects every inch of his boots. He finds a thin tracker, the size of his thumbnail, hidden inside.
I'm sure Adrian voiced that concern.
You are a unique talent, Libby. Unfortunately, I don't see a very happy ending for Martin Salehi in either scenario, unless you tell me right now if there's a copy and where I can find it. And then you and I can come to an understanding and you can just fade away.
All I can tell you is what I know. There's the original. A dozen notepads of material written in longhand. There is not a single copy. No hard copy, nor electronic. Leave Martin be. He is an innocent. Please, Rachel, do with me what you will. But let him be.
How could you do this? You had regret. You wanted out. I agreed to everything. Everything! But for you to go and write this betrayal? Because that's exactly what it is. It is a betrayal.
A betrayal for you. A reckoning for me.
Adrian and the soldiers return.
Madam President, you are needed.
What is it?
Rachel and Libby glare at each other. A soldier places the bag back over Libby's head. Martin is on a coach bus. It drives on a two-lane rural road.
I had to try. I owe her that much. All right, so tell me about Salehi.
Well, I lost him in Union Station. 30 seconds of confusion is about all it took.
How is that even possible?
He's a smart kid. He
found the tracker and stashed it along with his laptop in a bag on a bus headed to Des Moines. I know we thought the boy would lead us to other copies, but leaving the backpack was a mistake. We did go back and check the security videos. Saw he purchased a bus ticket to Springfield. And we have him boarding that bus.
Pull your team.
That would be a mistake.
The operation is blown.
The pads are in a backpack, which can be easily taken when the bus arrives. It'd look like a simple mugging.
No, it's already light in the Midwest. No, it's too risky. No.
Madam President, there are people that don't want that document made public, ever.
Like yourself.
There'll be no second term. You will be disgraced.
I will take my chances with the American people. They remember what it was like before Holmes. They remember the fear.
Impeachment followed by conviction.
It's not going to happen.
I don't think...
Look, Adrian, you work for me now. Is that clear?
Yes, ma'am.
The agency can more than handle its own affairs. Commission-proof intel is the phrase I remember.
This is dangerous.
Oh, we'll weather it. Stop it.
What should we do with the boy?
Let him go. I mean, he's the messenger.
Aunt Libby?
Take her home. It'll be her word against ours.
They look at each other in agreement.
The American people won't want to refight a war that's already won.
Rachel walks from the car onto a government plane. Two pilots salute as she embarks. Adrian stands by the car with his hands in his pockets. Martin opens the backpack again and slowly pulls out the gun. He looks up to check that no one is watching him. He checks the magazine and notices that it's empty. He tilts his head back in disappointment. The Mid-America's bus comes to a stop in Springfield. Martin rubs his eyes, slings the bag over his shoulder, and disembarks. In the back of a van.
Did Adrian fly in with you guys?
No. He stayed in California.
Martin looks across the street and sees Springfield Register Complex. He takes a deep breath and watches an ambulance speed by. Construction workers tend to the street in front of the building. The van comes to a stop.
Dr. Lamb, when your feet touch that ground, start walking and count to 20. Only then remove the hood. Understood?
Yes.
The back door slides open. A hand cuts the zip ties binding her and pulls her roughly by her shoulder out of the van. Arms stretched out in front of her, legs wary of knocking into something, she stumbles forward into the sunlight. Cars and people on the street are visible from the alley she's walking through. She tears off the hood and hunches forward to catch her breath. Looking up, she notices the Springfield Register complex. Her eyes lock on Martin, entering reception.
I'm Martin Selly. I'm here to see Philip Lamb.
Libby breaks into a run.
People say it's regarding his daughter, Elizabeth.
Let me try.
A woman in a gray polo delivers a package to the front desk. Libby enters into the middle of the street, sprinting. The receptionist signs for the package distractedly while speaking on the phone. Libby is hit by a car screeching to a halt. She rolls onto her hands and knees and crawls along the yellow painted line between cars. She gets up and turns to stop traffic. The receptionist inspects the toaster-sized package, turning it over in his hands. Libby makes it to the other side of the street and bounds up the steps before the building. She rips open the door.
Martin!
What the fuck happened?
You have to leave.
What? Hey, what?
They both look up to see Libby's dad exit the elevator.
Daddy.
The lights shut off.
Oh, no.
An explosion emanates from within the building. From the outside, black smoke and torn paper burst from the glass windows. Passersby are buffeted by the debris. Cars come to a halt on the street and hundreds of yellow charred pages are fluttering in the calming air. At the government building, Adrian strides through.
On the phone with the FBI.
He descends a set of stairs, passing agents wearing earpieces. Rachel is taking a call in a small lounge.
Okay, Fred. Yes, she was. Thanks. Just keep me posted. You know, about everything. Okay, thanks.
Adrian closes a door behind him, a smug look across his face. He watches her expectantly. Her eyes are glassy.
Get out.
Just putting the period on the sentence.
I said get out.
Of course, she was a dear friend. I'll make that clear in a statement.
Adrian exits and Rachel casts her gaze down.
As of now, there are 20...
Jordan sits in his dorm room watching news of the bombing.
Lamb, former National Security Affairs Advisor to then Vice President Burke and her father, Philip Lamb, executive editor of the Springfield Register, the site of the attack. We are learning the FBI now believes that the primary suspect, Martin Solly, acted alone...
Jordan sees a photo of his roommate in the report.
In the controversial strike on Homs, Syria, 4 years ago. Mr. Solly had family in Homs. Dr. Lamb, known as the architect of recent U.S. policy in the war on terror, advocated what came to be known as total victory. President Burke has been on the West Coast this week attending various fundraising events. She is in San Francisco this afternoon, and that is where Adrian Little...
Jordan looks up and places his laptop on the coffee table.
Good afternoon, everyone. President Burke is both saddened and stunned, as we all are, by this vicious act of terror and the death of our colleague and good friend. Elizabeth.
Jordan opens the door to two dark-suited agents.
Jordan Ritt, FBI.
In a utility room.
Look, Martin wasn't the easiest person in the world to get along with, for sure, but this just makes no sense. If what you're asking is, do I think Martin was capable of blowing himself up, murdering dozens of people, my answer is no. I don't believe that.
FBI agents disassemble their dorm room, taking boxes from behind crime scene yellow tape. Jordan has stopped at the door.
This is my apartment.
Nobody told you?
Jordan sits on a train station bench. He opens his phone and texts Neil. Can I come over? My room has become a crime scene, no lie. Neil responds, of course, you good? Jordan replies, just freaking a little. He puts his phone down and returns to his laptop. He begins deleting old email, checking the subject line of each. He pauses as he sees one from unknown sender. The subject is the fine art of conversation. Remembering the faculty event, the roommates attended.
Excellent conversation, if I do say so myself.
Congratulations on that.
Yes, it is a fine art.
He opens it. A flashback to Martin finding the tracker in his shoe. If you're reading this, that means I've failed. Martin exits the bathroom. The file is huge. The document's self-explanatory. Martin walks past several buses. Its importance undeniable. Martin enters an electronic shop. I'm sorry to burden you with this. There's no one else I trust. It's signed Martin. Finishing the email, Jordan looks up and checks his surroundings in the empty station. On the bus, Martin holds a camera phone and removes the notepads from the backpack. He begins to take pictures of each page. Jordan moves the mouse over the attachment. He clicks to open it. A page appears. It says, "On the events leading up to and through June 19, 2019, the nuclear strike on Homs, Syria, an eyewitness account by Elizabeth Lamb." Cut to black. Written and directed by Joe Chappelle. Produced by Colleen Griffin. Executive producers Candy Strait and Laura K. Lewis. Tika Sumter. Ben Tavazzoli. Deanna Dunnigan, Jeff Hefner, Alex Wiseman, Rex Lynn, with Clark Peters, and Jamie Lee Curtis, a Corrado Mooncoin production, An Acceptable Loss. Director of Photography, Petra Corner, AAC. Production designer, Daniel B. Clancy. Edited by Joe Rebig. Costume designer, Susan Kaufman. Original music by Valgair Sigurdsson. Casting by Barbara J. McCarthy. Senior visual effects supervisor, Rob Churchill. Senior visual effects producer, Derek Goldsmith. Audio description voiced by Michelle Spitz, Woman of Her Word. Produced by ActiveView.
Hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His truth is marching on. I have read a fiery gospel writ in burnished robes of steel. As ye deal with my contemners, so with you my grace shall deal. Let the hero born of woman crush the serpent with his heel. Since God is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His truth is marching on. He has sounded forth a trumpet that shall never call retreat. He is sifting out the hearts of men before his judgment seat. Oh, be swift, my soul, to answer him. Be jubilant, my feet. Our God is marching on. Glory, glory. His truth is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory. glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His truth.